the scripture, but it will be a different version for you. This is a First Nations version of scripture, so it's written by some indigenous people here from the United States.
It was late in the day, so his followers said to him, "This is a deserted place, and the day is almost over. We should send the people away to the villages in the countryside so they can find food to eat." Jesus looked around at the great crowd of people, over 5,000 men and also women and children. Then he turned and looked right at his followers. "You feed them," he said to them. They could not believe their ears. How could they feed so many people? "It would take over 8 moons worth of gathered food to feed all these," they answered him. "Do you want us to go and trade for that much?" Then he said to them, "Go and see how many pieces of fry bread we have." After looking around, they said, "We have 5 pieces of fry bread and 2 fish. Jesus instructed the people to sit down in groups on the green grass. So the people gathered up their traveling bundles and their children and sat down, some in groups of 100 and some in groups of 50. The word of the Lord for the people of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. Thanks, Deb. It was the best of times and the worst of times. You know that, right? I had just decided to go to seminary, and I was very excited about it. I kind of thought, you know, God was calling me to do this. I might even be called to do this. This might be my niche in life, right? So I was so excited about this. But then just a week before I began seminary, I got a call that something was wrong with my dad. He had had a funeral and said the same prayer 3 times in that funeral, the same exact prayer. And so the folks wondered what was going on, so they took him to the hospital, and it turned out that he had brain cancer, and it was inoperable. And before we could kind of get a hold of everything, my dad went into a coma, and they put him on a machine to keep him alive. We didn't want that, but that's what we weren't in time to get that figured out back then. And so we struggled for 2 weeks after that on trying to get my family, you know, 7 kids and mom, all in agreement that we should pull the plug, unplug him. And finally, we were able to do that. And he died right at the top of my kind of movement towards God. Here came this total disaster. And listen, one of the things I struggled with when I began to think about being a pastor was funerals, because I didn't have very good experiences with funeral. The only one I really remembered, I remember 2 of them. One, I think I've told you the story of my friend Lori, who died of leukemia in 4th grade, and me being the only 4th grade kid at the funeral. It was a terrible experience for me. And then when my sister Rachel died in a car accident, I remember that funeral. The whole community was there, and we should have seen it probably as support, but me being a 12-year-old and our family being in deep grief, we felt like they were all looking at us with, you know, binoculars and just kind of looking at us for all of our grief, and I felt so watched. I felt so horrible in that experience. And so, here comes my dad, who dies. Our church, the Howard United Methodist Church, wasn't big enough for the funeral. Dad was a very popular pastor. People loved him. And so we had to move the service to the Catholic Church, which fit my dad's kind of spirit. He was not just a United Methodist. He loved all people, loved Catholic towns. That's what he always said. "I love Catholic towns." "They're a little looser than we Protestants," he said. So we had it in the Catholic Church, and not one of us wanted to go. But we knew we just had to kind of, you know, bear down and get through it. So I remember having my mother's hand and walking down that aisle with, again, so many people watching us. And I remember whispering to Mom, "Mom, just put your head down. Let's get this thing done. Let's get it over. We'll just have to do our best." And that's what we did. You know, we listened. We put our head down. And we just tried to endure it. And we got through it, almost, until right at the end of the service, 100 United Methodist pastors, all of my dad's buddies and friends, got up to the front of the church, and they sang the song we just sang, "It Is Well." And they sang it with, I just can't even describe, if you can imagine, joy and sadness in the same voice. That's what I felt. There was one guy whose whole body was shaking with, just filling the place. They filled the place with, the only thing I could say is, wellness. Not one of them was not broken. Not one of them felt joy, but they felt well. And it was just one of those moments that in the deepest brokenness of my life, here came blessing. God's voice was speaking through these people. And I felt God's presence in my life. Now, how come I had never gotten that at a funeral? That a funeral isn't a bunch of people with binoculars on looking at you, I hope, but a community that is surrounding us in song, in faith, because they know we don't have any. They know they need to be there as a witness to being faithful. You know, I think this is the way we live our lives. Always in between blessing and brokenness. And I think it is very important for us to figure out how to do it. Because if we don't do it well, if we don't walk through this world understanding that there is blessedness and brokenness, we are going to get so bitter. We are not going to be able to come through the journey that we go through and be a people of hope in this world. We're going to lose it, and we won't be able to come back from it. We need to figure out how to walk between these two. Emerson, my granddaughter, is a third grader this year. And we've had quite a few conversations about third grade. I did not realize it was so complicated. I mean, she has been anxious about getting to third grade. She's worried about her teacher. She didn't know exactly who it was. I did mention that Heather's a third grade teacher, and how could you not want Heather as a teacher? But she was nervous about friends, nervous about grades, nervous about, you know, where she'd be, on and on and on it went. And so the day before she went to class, Cindy and I asked her to come up, and we wanted to encourage her, right? You know, tell her everything was going to be all right, and talk to her a little bit. And she started talking, and she got a little teary-eyed about her anxiety. And we tried to reassure her, saying she was going to do great. But she was still a little under it. But then she walked down the stairs, and on the way down the stairs, I don't know if Cindy put a penny on the step or what, but there on the step was a penny. And you know kids, you know, all it takes is a penny, right? And she reached down and she said, "Look, a penny. Look, I'm going to have good luck tomorrow. It's going to be great." You know that saying, don't you, Papa? And I couldn't remember the saying, but she knew it. And she said, "It's going to be a great day." And she ended up looking like she did going to school that first day. I don't think it was just the penny, but the penny meant something, right? You know, only a penny and the faith of a child can get you through that moment, I think. Annie Dillard has a great story about when she was 6 years old, just a little younger than Emerson, and she has this desire to hide treasure everywhere. So she takes a penny and she hides it behind one of her great big trees in her yard, and she writes all these notes on the sidewalk: treasure ahead, 15 steps forward and 6 to the south, or whatever. And she goes on and on. You can't beat it. Make sure you take a stop. You know, she's got these big signs on the sidewalk. And then she goes and she hides under the porch and watches. And she's sure everybody's going to stop for this treasure. Nobody even pauses. Not a one, she said, even looked down and saw her signs. And she goes on with this quote, if you can put that up for me. The world is fairly studded and strewn with pennies cast broadside from a generous hand. But, and this is the point, who gets excited by a mere penny? But if you cultivate a healthy poverty and simplicity, in other words, you actually look down, so that finding a penny will literally make your day, then, since the world is in fact planted in pennies, you have, with your poverty, bought a lifetime of days. It is that simple. What you see is what you get. Religion is really all about seeing the world. Debbie believes in God, but God scatters grace upon the whole world. But Debbie sees it, hopefully. But that's what it's about, seeing. And the problem with the disciples today in this story is they couldn't see. They didn't see the 2 fish and the 5 loaves as a blessing. They saw it as, oh, this is all we've got. I mean, we need all this, and this is all we've got, you know? How many of us look that way, right? We look at the world at what we don't have. You know, if we could just have all that stuff over there, or if I just had that brain over there. And then we don't see what we have. And we don't see it as blessing. My friend Rick Pittenger, and many of you have met him, he was at Vacation Bible School, and I have to just give him credit. I have the song, la 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 la, that we do when we clap hands and we do all different actions. And one of my favorites to do if I have a fairly short-haired person around, I was going to do it to Devin, but I saw Rick, was rub Rick's hair. And so all 40 of us got to Rick, and these kids were rubbing his hair, and he said, yeah, and they were pulling my beard and all sorts of things. But anyway, he was a great sport. But he was talking to me one day about his dad, and his dad was a preacher, a pastor, but he had a struggle with gambling. He grew up so poor in his life. He lived actually in a dugout basement all of his growing up, you know, in a dirt basement. And so money, you know, the lack of money meant something to him, and he wanted money. And so he got caught up in gambling, a serious problem of gambling. And Rick called me up one time, and he was so upset with his dad because somebody in South Dakota at the time had won the lottery. And it was this town called Winter, South Dakota, which was kind of out in the boonies. And he had won the lottery. Nobody knew who it was. They just knew it was somebody from Winter. So Rick's dad, of course, got in his car, drove 300 miles to Winter, South Dakota, because he was going to find who this guy was, and he was going to give him some advice. And Rick said, what kind of guy does this? Like, he thinks he has advice, and he said, you know what he really wants? He wants to give this guy advice, so this guy's going to share some of his lottery winnings with him. And he said, my dad, my gosh, My son has a ball game tonight, and he's going to skip my son's ball game just so he can go chase the lottery ticket he never won. And he said, that is my dad's problem. He's looking for the big lottery win, and he cannot see the blessings right in front of him. The children that want him to be there at their ball games. I think I can get that, right? How many of us have done the same thing? Maybe not lottery winning, but we've lost sight, right? We lose sight of where the blessings are. I travel Paradise Road every Sunday to get here. How many of you traveled that road? That is the prettiest road in the world, I am convinced. I remember the first time I rode that when I moved to Washington, I thought, I am never going to get old of this. This is blessing. I am going to see every green tree here. Look at all this. Yeah, 10 years later. Beep, beep, get out of my way. I'm late for church. You know, it's, wow, what happens, right? We lose sight of a God who scatters grace, not in $1 million, but in pennies. And that was the disciples' problem. Look, we get the disciples. They're just like us. I mean, that's why Jesus tells these stories. They have, I mean, and they make sense, right? Here they are. You know, it's just a small group of them. If you read the scriptures, it sounds like maybe 12 men. And then, you know, if you do the United Methodist numbers with this, 12 men, and then you add the women, it was probably about 150 people. Because women tend to outnumber guys. I mean, so we know there was a small gathering around them. And at first, that's all it was. But then Jesus started healing people. He started touching people. He started moving people. People started changing around him. And suddenly, it wasn't 100, 150 people. It was a UW stadium full of people following them wherever they went. And it became kind of a problem. I think if I was a disciple, I might have got a little resentful of all these people looking for the lottery, right? And they're just looking for the lottery. Big crowd, and then Jesus turns to them and says, hey, feed them. Are you kidding me? Can you imagine how much that's going to cost? That's like, it would take half my salary, a whole year's salary, to feed all these people. Jesus, just send them home. Let them feed themselves, for crying out loud. But Jesus doesn't get them off the hook. Jesus says simply, what do you have? Let me say that again. He doesn't say, what do you need? He says, what do you have? He doesn't say, what don't you have? He says, what do you have in your hands? And they say, 2 fish, 5 loaves. That's it. And you know how they say it. We don't have enough. This world is full of need. And we're a tiny church in Woodinville. That's all we got. But Jesus says, just give me what you got. And if you give it in faith, I'll help you do the rest. And that's what happens. What do you got? Not what don't you have. What do you got? What are you willing to give to this year at Bear Creek? Maybe you might say to yourself, oh, Brooke, I mean, I just don't have the energy I had 30 years ago. I don't. You got something, though. What do you got? Can you give it? Can you try to give it to God in a full heart and just see what happens? When I was in Vermilion, South Dakota, we had a church that wanted to do a feeding ministry, and they didn't know exactly what to do, so I pushed and prodded, and they decided to do this thing called the welcome table. They were just going to feed people every Monday night. Just open up the church and feed. And so we had this meeting, and you know how it gets. We started getting our memos out, and we started trying to work out all the details. How are we going to do this? And we got overwhelmed with all the things we didn't have and all the future. And finally, one of us just said, oh, come on. Let's just cook some ham. Let's just cut some ham up and cook it, and let's see what happens. We'll figure it out. Let God lead us. And that's what we did. We cut some ham, and we did some potatoes. And you know how many people showed up? 3 besides us. But we learned. And the next week, we did it again. And the third week, we went to the food stamp program and asked for a list of people that we might invite from them. And they actually gave it to us, which I don't think was legal. But we took that list, and we invited. And by a month, we had 150 there at that meal. That's what I'm asking you to do today, this year. Give what you got and see what happens. And all the people said,